Come, spellweavers, reavers, rogues, and men-at-arms, and answer the call of adventure. Pick up your sword, your axe, your spellbook, your bow, your rulebook, and your dice, and join the forces of good in their eternal fight against vile monsters, conspiring min-maxers, horny bards, and blood-soaked murder hobos. Discover the treasure trove of role-playing games here on Rollin' Bones. My name is Ryan Howard, and I shall be your guide. Good evening, boneheads, and welcome back to Rollin' Bones with Ryan Howard, where we are making old school young again. I'm your host and king of the boneheads, Ryan Howard. I am the R in OSR, and I'm really excited about our show tonight. We have Alex McCreese back with us for his third appearance on Rollin' Bones, and we're going to be talking all about simulationism tonight. But before we jump into that, I just want to remind everyone, if you enjoy what you're seeing tonight, remember to like, share, and subscribe. And you can, of course, find me on all of the following social medias down there at the bottom of the screen. I am at Howard_RyanGreg on Instagram and Twitter. YouTube is Rollin' Bones. And if you want to watch this on Twitch, you can do so at twitch.tv/RollinBonesRyan. We'll be adding Rumble here soon. I have filmed my first short-form video that will be used to launch my Rumble page. It'll also be used for YouTube. So, you know, you'll be able to see it on either platform. But the goal here is to eventually start live streaming on Rumble as well. And one last piece of housekeeping before we bring Alex back on. I want to remind everyone, the Bonehead Emporium is live over on TeePublic. So just so we have anyone who wants to buy one, I have sold one t-shirt already, which I am very, very happy about. I'm very grateful to whoever bought that t-shirt. Thank you so much. You don't know how much it means to me that you would want to wear, you know, my logo on your chest. I mean, that is honestly kind of humbling. But that's enough of my nonsense right now. Let's bring on the main event here. You guys know him and love him. He is the founder of The Escapist. He is also the creator of both Adventurer Conqueror King System, a.k.a. Axe, and Ascendant. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm Rollin' Bones welcome to Alex McCreese. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for the great welcome. Good to be here.
No problem at all. And a question we were pondering before we went live here, shortly before we went live here, that I want to now turn over to all of you who are watching. What would Conan the Barbarian sound like with a Texas accent? Since Robert E. Howard is himself a Texan, and we never actually got to hear him speak as far as I know or as far as Alex knows, what would Conan the Barbarian sound like as a Texan?
You need to do your little one-liner that you did for me because it was so good.
All right. By this axe I rule.
Awesome. Oh, man. I can't do accents very well. I can do a few. I can do like Yoda, but I can't do Texan.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's a skill that makes people laugh like a couple times, and then eventually your wife tells you to stop doing voices, or at least my wife does. So...
Right. Yeah, I can see that.
Crafty. I hope that was not the peak of the stream. Just me doing by this axe I rule. But, you know, we'll see how this goes. Anyway, now that I've completely sidetracked us, we're here to talk about simulationism.
That's right.
And to give people some background, a couple of you were actually there for it when this happened, and you're familiar with the individual who created this moment. But when I first went on Legion of Myth, I was talking about how the way that combat plays out in so many role-playing games, it's like a JRPG where you're essentially transported to this magical land where nothing around you is interfering with the combat, and you're taking turns whacking each other with weapons. And I think that's boring. I think it's kind of stupid for D&D, a game that's completely powered by your imagination and the images you can conjure. Why would you be able to swing a polearm in the narrow confines of a dungeon? And someone in chat said, Ryan's a simulationist. And the way they said it, it sounded like a slur. So with that, I am going to do a couple things. I am going to present and show people the article that you wrote on your Substack.
Dun, dun, and dun.
I'm also going to turn it over to you to talk about that side of things and why people use that as a slur in many cases.
Sure. Yeah, so I'm a simulationist as well, and it is used as a slur against folks who like the sort of game designs we do. And what triggered my article was actually kind of, it was a similar kind of online anecdote where, I was reading 4chan because they were discussing the Ascendant RPG. And among the comments and the critiques, one of the people says, the impression is that a literal autist designed this game for people who can't pull a hand wave. And it just felt like that's the classic criticism of simulationist games, right? Like they always, there's this critique like, oh, you have to be autistic, or they're overly complicated, or, you know, all this bevy. And, the critique kind of peaked in the early 2000s under the influence of this movement called the Forge or the Story Games movement. And, you actually have to read what they said to believe it because it's so over the top. But, you know, just as an example of the attitude that the Forge movement had, and the Forge was incredibly influential and its users have percolated all across the internet. They're on Twitter, they're on RPGNet, they're on EN World. They design, you know, Powered by the Apocalypse. So they sort of became the driving force for about a decade of game design. And this is the quote is, simulationism is a form of retreat, denial, and defense against the responsibilities of gamism and narrativism. Those outlooks acknowledge and require author stance and acknowledge the potential of personal failure. Simulation consists entirely of a retreat from danger. And then they go on to say that simulationists are brain damaged. So it literally was a slur to them. Mm-hmm. So the whole narrativist, simulationist, gamist, that all comes out of a discussion in the 1990s that was on Usenet. And there were these really heated debates about what's the point of role-playing games. And they kind of split into three groups. There were the simulationists, the gamists, and the dramatists, who later became known as the narrativists. And, you know, the flame wars back then used to be really, really intense. There were no real moderation. And that's what the Forge was birthed out of. And so I guess I'm a reactionary against the recent trends away from simulation. And, you know, I'm we're taking it back. We're taking the word back, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, as a libertarian and specifically the anarchist bent of libertarianism, I'm used to, one, people saying your beliefs are crackpot, and mm-hmm. two, like people just like outright dismissing your ideas as this is not something that could possibly work at all. So I have a sympathy for anything that's seen as almost like a lost cause of gaming. And this is definitely one of those places where there are people out there who, whether they know it or not, or whether they fully have the words to understand it or express it, they want this kind of game. They just don't know how to ask for it, and they've never experienced it before.
Right, right. Well, I once said that I'm either a sane man in an insane world, or I'm an insane man in a sane world, but the one thing I'm definitely not is a sane man in a sane world.
Right.
So, like, all of my views are contrarian and iconoclastic, so... You know, being a simulationist just fits right in, as you say. Yeah. What's funny to me is that outside of the context of tabletop games, everybody gets exactly why people would enjoy simulationism. But then suddenly you introduce it into tabletop games and people get really, really angry about it. But like, you know, let me give an example. So imagine you are watching a TV show or a movie, and at the start of the TV show or the movie, they say, based on a true story. Why do they say that? Why do the producers put based on a true story? It's because they know that if people believe it's real, if they know it's based on something that is real and genuine, then it is more moving and more powerful to them, right? Like mm-hmm. Black Hawk Down is a war movie, is a great war movie. But then when you realize that those events actually happened, like then it just hits you like a sucker punch and you really empathize for those characters. So there, right there, you're like, the more real it is, the more impactful it is. Or, you know, let me give another example, right? So there used to be this TV show called Spartacus, which was about, you know, the gladiator in Rome who led the slave revolt. Mm-hmm. And Spartacus was not per se a realistic show. It was really over the top, a lot of blood, a lot of gore, you know, leaping up in the air, sword coming down type stuff. Mm-hmm. But one of the things about Spartacus was the dialogue. And as you're watching Spartacus, if you speak Latin or you're familiar with Latin, you all of a sudden realize that all of the characters in Spartacus speak English the way English would have been spoken if it was Latin. So like they say things like put sword in hand, gratitude. And it's like this very minimalist dialogue. And all of a sudden it just took the show a whole nother level up for me because, hey, like they're actually simulating how these people would have spoken had they been actually Romans. And so it dialed the show up for me from like an 8 to a 10. And that extra oomph is part of the appeal to simulationists. And then, you know, the third appeal to simulationists of it being a real, let me give another example, right? So imagine you're playing chess.com and you keep struggling, you keep losing to the computer, you know, you're really frustrated, you're bitching about it to your roommate. And then one day, you sit down and you beat the computer and you're so exultant and you're so happy and you're thrilled with your victory. And then you find out that your roommate reduced the difficulty without telling you because he wanted you to have a good time.
Yeah.
Right. And all of a sudden the exaltation of the victory is taken away. Right. Everybody would understand that. Like you would feel crushed and like, oh, and yet that's exactly what fudging is. When you're playing Dungeons and Dragons, right? The GM is literally taking away your ability to actually enjoy the exultation of victory by lowering the difficulty level on you.
Yeah.
And as a simulationist, I don't like that. You know, and any of those examples is non-controversial in any other medium, but suddenly you get into tabletop role-playing games and it makes people very upset.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to me because I've had this exact conversation with people before, specifically when I mention things like I like the concept of weapon mastery from Rules Cyclopedia, mm-hmm. where you have to train with specific weapons,
yep.
and it introduces this kind of gamble aspect of, you know, you've put all of this time and energy and money into training with a polearm, but now you find yourself in a situation where using a polearm is going to be at best impractical.
Right.
So you have to lean back on using your shield and your short sword. You've created now a puzzle out of combat. You've created mm-hmm. something that the player has to solve. And for my money, I think that's a cool thing because, you know, now the circumstances have changed. You're not just able to get by doing what you've done every single combat, you know, from the beginning up until this point. You now have something different that you have to do. So how are you going to overcome it?
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think so that's both in terms of the threefold theory I mentioned earlier. So that's both a gamist and a simulationist outcome, right? Like it's mm-hmm. gamist in the sense that it creates a challenge that you want to enjoy. And it's simulationist because it's reflecting reality that you can't use a polearm in a very narrow hallway, for instance, right? Like there's a reason urban fighters fight differently than on the field of battle. And a lot of games ignore that because they think, well, if the player has invested a lot of points in pole arm, it would really suck for him not to get to use his pole arm in a cool fight because that wouldn't be cool. And I think you're thinking about it in the correct way. Like, no, actually that creates interesting puzzles for the players, and maybe they're looking for ways to not have that fight now, whereas they would have been happy to have the fight if it had been under the circumstances of their choosing. Or maybe they're retreating, or they're trying to move back outdoors where they can use their weapon, etc. Mm-hmm.
And you've hit on another point, because I mean, like you said, that's both a gamist and a simulationist outcome. You've hit on a point that I've heard you make before, and then my friend Crossface has echoed the same point. Simulationism is it's a backbone that makes the other aspects of role-playing games work better. It makes the narrative better. Yep. Because you've introduced these kind of real-world circumstances that your players have to overcome, and when they reach the end of it, they now have a story of how they overcame insurmountable odds, and it makes the game better because it adds more layers to the gameplay. So the simulation thing really does kind of strengthen all aspects of the game, in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that's kind of what I was alluding to with my earlier examples, right? Like the, you know, the Spartacus example, that's just pure simulation enjoyment. You're just taking pleasure in the fact that they simulated how Romans talk, right?
Yeah.
The Black Hawk Down hitting you emotionally harder, that's actually making the narrative more powerful on you, right? It's like the joke of the girl who starts crying because she finds out Titanic was a true story. And it really sunk. And then, you know, so that improves the narrative feel. And then obviously like the chess.com example is gamist in the sense that if you're not, you know, if you're not doing it real, you know, the exaltation of victory is taken away. So I completely agree with Crossface and that whole gang. Like, simulation is a backbone that makes all aspects of tabletop gaming better.
Mm-hmm. And Victor in chat here points out simulationism makes gun combat a little bit more fun in RPGs, where a lot of RPGs tend to make gun combat feel a little boring or just a little weak. I think taking a simulationist approach to especially modern firearms, you know, tends to make guns feel a little bit more fun in role-playing, where otherwise they just kind of feel like crossbows that shoot more.
Yeah, that's right. If you're not modeling a lot of factors, then they're either crossbows that shoot more or instant kill weapons, depending how they write them. Yeah, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Like Cyberpunk 2020, I thought, did a pretty good job of simulating firearms combat with their Friday Night Firefight rules. You know, and they had cover and armor penetration, reloading, jamming, headshots. It was a good time.
Yeah. And Pepe Clifton also makes a good point here. Because D&D is born out of war games, simulationism and really heavy simulationism, where things like weather and I think even in some games, like the health of your troops and like the food that they were able to have access to influence the battle itself. So RPGs have, they've evolved in a different direction from wargaming, but there is this DNA of simulationism that still exists, even in the most like storytellerish RPG still has its roots somewhere in D&D, which has its roots in simulationism.
That's right. It does. And I think the wargaming example is a good way to grok what simulationists are all about, because so wargames themselves grew out of the German or Prussian Kriegsspiel, right? Mm-hmm. Which were military training games that they used to train officers for the Prussian general staff. And the Kriegsspiel community, you can imagine them like being on the 19th century equivalent of Twitter, split into two opposing camps, which was, you know, the rules Kriegsspiel and the free Kriegsspiel. And the rules Kriegsspiel had all these huge manuals with all these charts and matrices and weather tables and things like that. And then the Free Krieg Spiel, you simply had a really expensive, experienced old Prussian general who would run the game and make up what he thought should happen based on what the players said. And but what's interesting is that they have basically all the rules in a game that's way more complex than anything that anybody plays today. And then they have virtually no rules, but they both are trying to simulate war, right? Like at no point, for instance, if you're doing a Kriegspiel of the Battle of Waterloo, right? At no point does the Free Kriegspiel judge be like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to give Napoleon's troops more hit points because that'll make the battle more fun, right? Yeah. You know, at just no point does he do that, right? At no point does he say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to have those cannons actually kill off Wellington because that'll be more dramatic and make the battle more exciting. You just didn't do that because that was not the point of the whole exercise.
Right.
And I think that Kriegspiel example gives the lie. It proves that it's a lie that simulation has to be complex. It doesn't have to be. It's a philosophy. There are different ways you can simulate. And so this whole criticism that, oh, if you're a simulationist, then, you know, go play GURPS and Hero System, blah, blah, blah. Like, no, you can actually take a simulation approach to even a rules-like game if that's what you want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think what a lot of it comes down to and why simulationism gets the rap that it does is there's so many people in the hobby that are afraid of the dreaded C word, and that's crunch.
Mm.
Crunch, that's another one of those words that people throw around like it's a slur. And I've even done this in the past. And I think where I've kind of landed on crunch is crunch that makes your world and your game more complex as far as like there's deeper layers to everything that's going on, but doesn't get in the way of the actual gameplay is good crunch. Crunch that makes a turn last 10 minutes is bad crunch.
Right.
And so you have to, like Pathfinder, I think is a good example of bad crunch. And it has that reputation of, you know, you have to add this and you have to add that. And I know like Pathfinder fans don't yell at me. I haven't actually played Pathfinder. These are just like the impression that I get from communities around RPGs is that, but that doesn't mean that we have to completely throw crunch out entirely.
Right. Right. Yeah. A friend of mine, a guy named Matt Jarmack, he wrote Oryx and Meraki's Almanac of Unusual Magic for Autark. He said, I thought it was a great quote. He said that complexity is the price you pay for depth. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, are you getting your money's worth?
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, some people don't want very much depth, so they don't want very much complexity. And sometimes you have enormous amounts of complexity that somehow don't actually create very much depth. But that sweet spot is when you have just enough complexity to create the amount of depth for the game you want to run. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's hard to achieve. And most game designers nowadays don't even really focus on game mechanics very much. They focus on fluff and story and narrative and good art and things like that. So.
Yeah. But in one of my threads, when I was talking about armor, I mentioned how I would like the option to have layered armor in fantasy games, because when you look at a knight's armor, it's not just plate. You have the plate that's on top of it, but you have a layer of mail underneath it. You have gambeson underneath that. The plate itself is made up of different components that may or may not be present depending on the context of the battle. And so I just wanted to float out the option of what if, instead of just writing down, I have this armor set, you have layers and you have some way to visualize those layers. Building upon these layers of armor gives you penalties to movement, but also gives you an increased armor class. You still have just one number that you're comparing an attack against, but there's additional complexity and depth to it that also lends itself to, contextually speaking, if you're a fighter and you are traveling in the wilderness, you're not going to be wearing full plate because that'll slow you down. You're at best going to be wearing a gambeson with a mail hauberk over top of it, or a mail shirt, and maybe like some pauldrons or a some kind of like breastplate. That's the best you're going to have in that situation, because that's what you can travel in. But you still have some level of protection there.
Right. Right. Yeah. I wrote a whole supplement in my Axioms e-zine called All About Arms and Armor, where I offered up all the rules to do that sort of thing, and had a good time researching it. And, you know, I got into like difference between bronze and iron and steel, and, you know, various like laminated linen armors they used to use in the ancient world, and how they all stacked up together, and differences from like bludgeoning attacks versus penetrating versus slashing. You know, it was pretty, you can make a very cool game out of that with real choices for players. But not too many folks do.
Mm. Yeah. And I think people think it's more complicated than it actually is.
Right.
And it's one of those things where, and again, maybe I should just try to create a supplement for this and see if I can make it work in a system that people already use, something like Castles and Crusades or 5e or OSE, see if I can make layered armor functional within that ecosystem. But I think it just needs, again, someone to show an example of this is how it would work. And yes, there's complexity, but, you know, it doesn't slow your game down at all. It's just, you know, it's like having to manage rations or torches. It's just another thing to manage that in the real world, someone had to manage.
Right. Right. Yeah. Although, you know, there's a whole contingent of people who think it's crazy that they're supposed to track their rations and torches. So, but you should write that. I think you should, you know, write that as a supplement and get it out there. And, you know, the hobby certainly, I think, needs more people designing that type of content. There is an audience for it. I mean, you know, Ascendant is a simulationist game, and it was my fastest selling game I ever released, right? Everybody was like, you're crazy to make a simulationist superhero game. It can't be done. But sold great. Now I'm already on my second printing, and it's only been 2 years. So, which reminds me, I wanted to say why I think simulation gets a little bit of a bad rap. And yep. I think it's two different things. So, in many ways, being a game master is much harder than being a player, right? Like the time commitment that you have to put in, the investment is a lot more substantial. And so there's kind of a selection effect of who ends up as game masters. And very often the people that end up as game masters are the people who really enjoy writing and storytelling. And so that aspect of the art of game mastering almost naturally gets overemphasized by them. And so there's a temptation to take it very personally when someone says, no, you should back off. You should, you know, focus on simulating the world and let the players tell their story. And I speak from experience. When I was a young man, I did all the usual things of railroads and tight story arcs and all those things. And so a lot of the hostility to simulation comes from, I think, game masters who feel that it's an attack on their storytelling abilities. The other thing I've noticed is that nowadays a lot of campaigns end up very short, and people don't get to enjoy long-term campaigns with running groups as much as they used to. And so there's a particular experience you get from a simulation RPG in a long-term campaign with a group, where everything just becomes more and more real to the group. So that, like, in a real sense, you know, when Newton saves Jim from the dragon, like, that is an event that really happened in this sort of shared reality that you've built together for years. And only a simulation game can really create that. But since players often get very short campaigns nowadays, 5 sessions, 10 sessions, maybe 20 sessions, they never get to experience that. And so they instead just hunger for kind of instant gratification. And they see, you know, anything that stands between them, like, oh, I didn't have fun this session, so therefore the GM sucks. which is, when you're doing a simulation game, you can't guarantee that every session is going to go the player's way, because sometimes it just won't go their way. So I think it's those two points. It's the shortage of game masters and the self-selection effect, and the instant gratification needs of players who don't play long-term campaigns anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And this was something that I was talking about around kind of the whole fudging argument today. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, bringing Hans Hermann Hoppe into this, it's a time preference problem.
It is. It is. Yes.
It's the people who play kind of narrativist games tend to have a high time preference. They want to sit down and play their favorite fantasy novel.
Right.
And people with a lower time preference are willing to see through what could be, you know, a difficult session where, yeah, we had to retreat from that fight. We lost, you know, three party members and we had to run away. We didn't get the treasure. But when you come back and kill that dragon that killed three of your party members and you take their loot, you find their bodies, you give them like a hero's burial, you have a narrative at the end
That's right.
Came from the simulation. So you have to fully appreciate a game like this, you have to have a lower time preference for kind of that ultimate experience of I played through a fantasy novel.
So I want to run with that that analogy you just made, right? Because one of the things we know about you know, people with a longer time preference versus a shorter time preference is if you tend to have a very short time preference, you tend to consume rather than save because you value the immediate gratification. And if you have a longer time preference, then you invest and save and you get compounding returns. And so in economics, the person with the longer time preference ultimately ends up becoming wealthier at the end of the day. Like, you know, their reward in 10 years is substantially more money than the person with a short time preference who spends and spends and spends. And I think the exact same thing is true of simulationism, where it's true that in the short term, you can get a flashy, fun experience. It never pays off as much as the payoff of a long-term simulationist campaign. And granted, the counter argument there is like, well, I could die tomorrow. And so I'm not going to invest in this long-term investment. And likewise, like the GM might move tomorrow. So I'm not going to invest in a long-term campaign. And I get that, you know, but I guess it feels to me like the simulationists are willing to acknowledge why the narrativists might want to play they want to do, but the narrativists don't acknowledge the value of simulationist play. And I find that odd.
Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, I kind of see it as a false dichotomy where the narrativist players seem to think that you can't have those kind of cool, amazing moments in a simulationist game. And you very much can.
You absolutely can.
Like even you still have the same feeling of, you know, we laid out this plan of how we're going to attack the orc encampment. We did our homework. We really plotted this whole thing out from beginning to end, and we pulled it off flawlessly without a hitch. Everything went our way this time, and it was awesome. Or even, you know, we tripped the alarm, and the camp was able to wake up before we thought they would be able to. So we had to fight our way through a horde of orcs, and that was awesome because, hey, look, we all survived. You still have those moments in a simulationist game.
For sure.
It's just... And I think it's even more rewarding because you know that your GM is being honest with you about, you know, yes, the dice are actually going this way. You're actually doing everything that you think you're doing. So it's backed up by this level of authenticity to know that wasn't just the GM trying to humor us. We actually did that.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And when I look back at my gaming experiences, you know, I've been running games for 41 years at this point. When I look back at them, by far, the experiences that everyone remembers the most and still talks about years later are the unexpected emergent stories that occurred because we played it real and we let the player choices and the consequences happen as they happened. And, you know, no reward I've ever gotten from running or playing in a story game has ever been close to that. And, you know, you don't just doesn't matter as much. The lack of authenticity makes it hollow, I think. You know, we had one game of Cyberpunk 2020 we were playing where it was a kind of a player versus player campaign. It was very competitive, and they had advisors to the government of Malagay trying to fight a counterinsurgency. And so, you know, it was a little bit of a spoof on like Vietnam advisors, but in a kind of a cyberpunk vibe. And the group at a certain point just decided they were going to take over the country and kill off all of the top leadership. But then they couldn't decide who among them was going to be the new, you know, generalissimo, the new premier. And so the group split into two factions, organized around this guy named Jim and this guy named Brian, each of whom was kind of, you know, edging to be the generalissimo after the coup. And it ends up in a shootout, and Brian's faction wins. But at the end of it, there's only three of them left. Everyone else is dead. So Brian and then these other two fellows, Lynn and Jesse, realize they don't have enough manpower anymore to actually stage the coup. But, you know, so they have to flee the island. And so they flee the island, and unknown to them, the other faction has put a bomb in their helicopter. So they take off to flee the island, and the guy with the cybernetic hearing hears the bomb ticking. And so, you know, they're looking through the helicopter and they find the bomb and they go to roll to defuse it. And, you know, Cyberpunk, you roll a D10. If you get a one, it's a potential botch. You roll again for the severity of the botch. So everyone is gathered around the table, right? All the dead people, all the live players are all gathered around the table. And, you know, they roll the disarm. They get a one. They get a 10. The helicopter blows. And every single person in the campaign is dead. And they're, you know, they're just obliterated. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't possibly have come up with that as a story that I would have written, right? Like, all of you will massacre each other in your greed for power and treachery. But that's where we ended. And it was amazing. And you only get that with a simulation.
And the thing about that moment, again, in how it reinforces the narrative side of things, you can see the image in your mind of the last of the losing side guys, like right before he dies, looks up and sees the helicopter explode, and he just kind of chuckles and then dies.
Yeah, like totally. Yeah.
That's a cinematic moment, but it was created in a simulationist way.
Exactly, dynamically. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, go ahead.
I was just saying, I mean, there's just so many such anecdotes from years of play. So, you know, I mean, like, I'm currently taking a little bit of heat online for sort of promoting simulationism and saying don't fudge and whatever. But, you know, I feel like I need to evangelize it, because it's such a great experience when you really are able to run those games. And I'm like, you know what? Take your shots at me. I've been on the other side, and I know what I'm talking about. And so I just want to evangelize it as a style of play to make sure it doesn't fade away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Full Metal Dragon brings up another good point here. The influence of the internet on modern game design, and how, I mean, we've all seen how the internet has created more of a culture of instant gratification. Mm-hmm. But I do think you're starting to see this a lot more, especially once you get into like the fourth edition era, where MMOs become so influential on how tabletop RPGs are designed. And then even now, the Critical Role actual play influence, where people are like, oh, I want the silly moments that my favorite Z-list celebrities are creating in their actual plays. So I think that's a good point there, that we kind of have to, like, that's ultimately what we're battling against is instant gratification and convincing people that in the long run, this is better.
Right. And look, you know, you can look at our culture and you can see the battle against instant gratification has been a losing battle, right? Yeah. I did this TEDx talk back in 2013, and I was talking about the pernicious effect of internet usage and instant gratification on the mind and on people's reading comprehension and intellectual ability. And you know, and at the time I made like a joke about how you know, internet shorts had, you know, gotten so short that, you know, I couldn't even imagine what the next step would be. And lo and behold, they invented TikTok, where it's even shorter, you know, and took off, and it's, you know, billions of video views. So the battle against instant gratification is a losing battle overall, but I think we can nevertheless create a stronghold or a cauldron where we can fortify our defenses and announce our views, and those who are of like mind will find us, and the others will go their way. They'll play the TikTok of RPGs.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I mean, I even see that with like the way that my wife and I consume media differently. I have no problem on like a Friday night sitting down and watching a 3-hour movie. My wife cannot watch a 3-hour movie, but she can watch 3 hours worth of 22-minute or 44-minute TV episodes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's right. The and my wife is the same, actually. But she can also watch like 8 uninterrupted hours of YouTube of 15-minute videos. I can't do that. But I can watch a 3-hour movie. So I don't know. There's something going on in our minds, and I don't think we fully understand the full impact of our content diet at this point.
Right. So. Yeah, it's a lot of stuff. And this is, I mean, this is even getting beyond the simulationist conversation. There's a lot of stuff about what we've done to ourselves over the past, 25 to 30 years, where we've just kind of continuously escalated beyond even what we understand psychologically. In a lot of ways, there's a lot of things that we've just kind of accepted as normal, where we haven't even taken a minute to think about, okay, what's this doing to us?
Right. That's right. That's right. We're not, but our society is currently also racing at a breakneck pace towards artificial general intelligence too. And
yep.
It's interesting. I wrote this essay the other day about what interesting times we live in. It's really easy to overlook the fact that actually right now is one of the most interesting times a human being could possibly ever have been alive in. And, it's dreadful.
Yeah. Yeah. And Pepe makes another good point here. Sorry, that's the wrong one. We're loaded with dopamine microdoses. It's like I've been reading Hardwired recently. And I can't remember the button heads, the people who have like connected essentially pleasure giving devices directly into their brains walking around. Yep. If you think about it, that's all of us now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the connection is not direct, but I mean, we know from leaked records from Facebook and those other social media companies that it's deliberate, right? They're doing it on purpose to addict us to the dopamine hits. And video game designers are as well. I have a good friend who's a game designer at a major studio, and he came up in the 90s, did some platinum sellers in the early 2000s, and he says that being a video game designer is a terrible job now, and he hates it because it's all about just creating addictive gameplay loops, and he feels like he works for a Las Vegas casino, and he's thinking about leaving the profession. So in that sense, I think we could even take a moral argument that long-running face-to-face tabletop simulations is actually really healthy for our brains. It's a break from that dopamine cycle. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we need to drag people kicking and screaming to move that way for their own good. For their own good, I'm going to make you play Axe.
Absolutely. And that's actually, that's something that Orcus Dorcas's son mentioned couple weeks ago. He's 15 years old, so almost everything in him and his friends' lives are these microdoses of dopamine. But tabletop role playing, which they do in person around a table face to face, is different. It's something different for them. So it's an experience where they are actually slowing down. Are actually, engaging their brains in a different way and enjoying something in a different way. So
yeah,
we're seeing it, but I think even the younger generation is picking up on this as well.
I think there's an interesting gap between the millennials and the zoomers on this, because, the millennials didn't grow up with quite as much of the instant dopamine hits as the zoomers have. So for the Zoomers, you know, it's been inescapable for them their whole lives. And I've often thought how grateful I am I didn't have to go to middle school and high school in an internet era where, you know, if you're unpopular, the unpopularity never turns off, right? Like it used to be, you could be a geek and you could escape high school and go home and play with your friends and like sort of the world turned off. Doesn't do that anymore. And I wonder if the Generation Z, the Zoomers, are going to be more receptive to alternatives because of that. And I hope so. I hope so. Because, you know, the story gaming, the story gaming movement was definitely driven by millennials.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It's, and I laugh because, you know, I'm a late millennial. So I very much grew up in the millennial culture. I saw it kind of, you know, rise, and I'm watching it fall now. But I remember all of those articles about, you know, millennials are killing this and that, but they weren't wrong. We did actually kill a lot of things that we probably shouldn't have killed. Mm-hmm. And now we're starting to realize, wait, you know, to paraphrase Chesterton, we took down the fence before we asked why it was there in the first place. And now things are getting through that we don't want to get through. So maybe we should, you know, reconsider what we've done here.
Yeah, man, you've dropped Hans Hermann and Chesterton, right? Time preference, like this is hot shit. So,
I've got a completely and otherwise useless philosophy degree on the other side of my light rigging over here. So I have to use it at some time.
Yeah. You know, the Chesterton's fence is funny in that I think a lot of what the so-called BroSR has been doing is a very Chestertonian approach to Dungeons and Dragons, right? Like, don't change anything until you understand why it was there in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I have to admit, as a game designer, one of the things that annoys me is people will buy Axe, and then before they've ever played it, they've already house ruled it in tons of ways. And then they come and complain to me that, you know, this doesn't work or this is broken or whatever. I'm like, no, it's not that it's broken. You broke it, right? Like, it worked just fine for what it was supposed to do. You've broken it. And I think the BroSR has kind of done a good job in setting that message out there that, you know, there are ways that games are supposed to work.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you can't house rule. But just like it doesn't mean you can't remove Chesterton's fence, but before you take down the fence, you got to know why it's there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's funny because, you know, the aforementioned Crossface and then also Crafty Matt, who's in chat here, they will both kind of get in like knockdown dragouts on Twitter just by telling people you need to read the rule book.
Yes, exactly. Which is crazy, right? And again, I go to any other hobby, right? Like, if you told someone who wanted to play football that they should learn the rules of football, they'd be like, oh yeah, of course you should learn the rules of football, right? Like, if you talk to sports fans, they know everything about the intricate details of their sport. But then you tell someone who says they're going to run a 5e campaign, like, oh, you should read the DMG. Nah, man, I don't have to do that shit. GM's rule is law. It's kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy to me.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's what RTFM is. That's read the fucking manual.
Read the fucking manual. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, and I have some sympathy for the fact that a lot of the manuals are badly written.
Yeah.
Or don't actually explain the rules, you know, and also like there was a recent leak. Apparently Wizards of the Coast at its big D&D get together that I wasn't invited to revealed that the system for balancing encounters in the D&D rulebook was wrong. They had actually purposefully included the wrong rules for balancing encounters. And so you think about that, like you're telling these people, here's your rule book that'll help you have fun sessions, and it actually doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It's like, no wonder people are skeptical about reading the manual. You know, if the game design is crap, then you're better off ignoring it. But it creates this vicious cycle where people expect that the game designers are going to suck at their jobs and create crappy game designs, so then they ignore the rules, and then what happens is game designers say, well, rules don't matter because they just ignore them anyway. So let's just invest in having really sexy art and lots of fluff. And so you get these games that no one really plays them. They just read them.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that probably plays into why, I mean, just to use a recent controversy as an example, the most recent Spelljammer didn't include any kind of ship-to-ship combat rules because they probably figured, why bother?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Why bother? Right, right. And you kind of see that across the board. You know, or also, like, look at any Kickstarter for any tabletop RPG, and what do you see them using to sell it, right? It's art, it's fluff, it's backstory. And very little, you know, very little of it is about, like, how does this game actually play and what makes it mechanically superior? Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is all part of the crucifix upon which we simulationists are nailed. We have to overcome these challenges.
Yeah. And it reminds me a lot of, and you use this analogy in your fudging video today, professional wrestling. The kind of professional wrestling that I like as a fan of professional wrestling is the kind where it looks so much like a real fight that I can pretend for the duration that it is a real fight.
Right.
Where I can, or where in my mind I go, it looks like they're really hitting each other. That right. to me is a good professional wrestling match. However, a lot of what we're delivered in modern professional wrestling doesn't look like it could ever even theoretically be a real fight with some of the stuff that people are doing. And so there's this aspect of simulationism, even in that media, that yeah. I long for, that no one seems to want to deliver anymore.
Well, you know, for decades, the professional wrestling leagues worked incredibly hard to maintain the pretense that it was real, right? They had a term for it, kayfabe, right? Which was the you never broke character, you never admitted it was fake. And, you know, they went to the mattresses to claim it was real.
Yeah.
And you think, well, why would they do that? And it's because people really value that. They really value the sense of the real. I called it a noetic appreciation from the Greek word nous, which is the ability to discern the truth. People have a sense of noetic appreciation. And, you know, and I think once pro wrestling kind of admitted it was fake, it lost some of its appeal, and particularly as it became more and more extravagantly fake.
Yeah.
And I think the same, that the analogy is to a game master, right? Who maybe for a while, maybe for 5 sessions, maybe for 10 sessions, he can spin you along and make you think, you know, it's all real, but then eventually you catch him fudging. And everything's in doubt, and the game loses its luster.
Yeah. Yeah, and you even, you see game masters and even game companies do the same thing. The people who are like, come on, it's just a game. You know, it's not real. That argument, when you have already prefaced your game with, we're not taking this seriously, to me, at that point, you've already reduced the amount of fun I can have by like a significant amount. It's down here now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Whereas, and I try to do this as best I can with my players, even before I got on the simulationism kick, I tried to do this. I was like, this is the world we live in for however many hours we're playing. You know, nothing outside of, you know, Athas, to use Dark Sun as an example, because I love running Dark Sun. Nothing outside of Athas exists right now. You guys are in this paradigm. Do what you can to put yourself in that mindset where, you know, you get down into the aqueducts of Tyr. You see the source of the city's water, and it's more water than you've ever seen in your entire life.
Right, right. You know, it... I talked about this a little bit in my book. A lot of folks nowadays seem to have trouble getting into the mindset of a person who isn't a 21st century American modern.
Yeah.
And if you can't do that, that just forecloses so many interesting settings and opportunities, right? Like, you know, you can't play in Rome if you're going to view everything about the Roman Empire as problematic. Well, then, you know, your Roman RPG campaign is dead on arrival. And I think that that's why we're seeing so many of the existing campaign settings all kind of almost, it's like they almost are all triangulating onto just being American Northwest cities, but with dwarves and elves. And, yep. You know, as a simulationist, I find that really depressing and disappointing. Like, that's not what I want to play or do. Like, for me, a big part of it is, as you say, it's nothing else exists right now but the game world that we're in, you know, Athos or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's why we got to bring it back, man.
Absolutely.
We got to start a crusade.
Yes.
A movement.
We can be RP guerrillas, if you
yes, will. Yes, we are RP insurgents against the established story game powers.
And you can buy an RP Guerrillas t-shirt on the Bonehead Emporium over on TeePublic.
Amazing. Amazing. I need an RP Guerrilla.
I made you that unit patch. I don't remember. I think I sent it to you on Facebook, but I sent you like a custom unit patch that worked your logo into it.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Awesome. I've always wanted to do a t-shirt that was a guy showing up to join the Taliban and everyone else there is holding RPG-7 rocket launchers and he's holding a copy of the player's handbook and like and his recruiter is like, wrong type of RPG, you moron. I just think that would be a hilarious shirt because it would be so inside baseball to even understand the joke.
Yeah,
which is my favorite type of humor.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, I should do, I have some t-shirts on my storefront, but I don't ever promote them. I should work on that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're smart. You're like, hey, I have a YouTube channel. I can promote them on my YouTube channel. It just like never even occurred to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Humor like that. I mean, personally, I find it hilarious as well. It was Michael Curtis. I had Michael Curtis on the show and we talked about how we want a t-shirt that has a bald naked Fofford shouting the jug on it.
Right. Right. You know, you just, no one's going to get it, but it's, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause then you see like the one person just randomly in public who does get it. And suddenly you've made a new best friend.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, well, we'll have to come up with some creative t-shirts, man. We'll, it can't pay worse than tabletop game design.
Yep. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, this is from way back in our conversation. But I was just looking for a place to put this in here. Full Metal Dragon, Ron Edwards was proven wrong because of the popularity of D&D 3.5 and Pathfinder 1E, which are very much simulationist in design. Do you agree that those are kind of simulationist games?
Yes, I think they're simulationist hyphen gamist games. So they're not strictly trying to be simulationist, but they certainly, I mean, you know, you just can read the rules and they took a ton of time to think about things like temperature, weather, you know, climbing difficulty, et cetera, et cetera. And I do think Ron Edwards was proven wrong. Like his, yeah. So his fundamental thesis was, it was two things I think that he turned out to be really wrong in. So one was he believed that narrativism, gamism, and simulationism were mutually exclusive and you could only have one of the three.
Yeah.
And I think, and as we talked about earlier, we think that's totally wrong, right? We actually think that simulationism, by pursuing it, gives you actually the other two at an even higher level. And so that's, I think he was very wrong there. The other area where I think he was wrong is he took the position that your relationship to your character didn't matter to whether or not it was a role-playing game, right? Like he said, it is all the same if you treat your character like it's a pawn, if you immerse yourself in your character, or if you take the point of view of an author trying to tell an interesting story about your character. And mm-hmm. I think that's completely wrong on a theoretical level. Like, I actually think that's the distinction between a war game, a role-playing game, and a story game. In a war game, whatever you're moving around is just pawns. In a role-playing game, you're taking the role of that character. And in the story game, you're the author of that character.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, that's why I think The Forge has never been nearly as commercially successful as some of the games like Pathfinder and D&D have been. Because I think that it's a design dead end that leads you into these hyper-specialized niches that don't really scratch the itch for a lot of people. Obviously, they have their fans, you know, and those people are welcome to their fun. But Edwards took the position that by following his philosophy, you'd have, you know, best-selling games that would make D&D, you know, look like esoteric niche hobbies. And that turned out to not be the case.
Yeah. And when it comes to, like, specifically the narrativist games, obviously Vampire had its day. It's not nearly as popular as it was at its height. But besides White Wolf, besides Vampire, what else, like, are there millions and millions of people like clamoring to get in on a Powered by the Apocalypse game? Are there people just, you know, kicking down the doors to play, you know, The Burning Wheel or, you know, whatever? All of these games have very small communities that are very rabidly devoted to these games. But again, at the end of the day, they're only ever going to be these small communities because they, you know, these games aren't giving people what they want. And just as an example of the potential audience that simulationism has, Shadiversity has 1.6 million subscribers on YouTube. Scalagrim has 1.56 million. Metatron has 680,000 subscribers. These guys basically devote their entire careers to talking about medieval realism in fiction,
right?
And how to incorporate that stuff into role-playing games, books, movies, and they're popular. So why can't we grab it? Like, a quarter of that audience would be amazing.
And you know what those guys have come to understand that I feel like the tabletop game design community largely is ignoring is that, as I said, it's noetic appreciation, right?
Yep.
Like, you were, so I wrote this on my blog. So noetic appreciation is the opposite of suspension of disbelief.
Yeah. Okay?
So suspension of disbelief is when you ignore what you know to be true in order to enjoy a piece of fictional content, right? So, you know, I know that Spartacus didn't actually leap up into the air 6 feet and, you know, fight like he was a wire fu kung fu artist, but I ignore that in order to enjoy the show.
Yeah.
Noetic appreciation is when you use what you know to be true to enjoy the entertainment even more. And everyone talks about suspension of disbelief, but almost nobody talks about noetic appreciation. But like these guys like Shadiversity, they've totally tapped into that. And it's fascinating. Everybody wants it to be real.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is another thing that I got kind of raked over the coals for with one of my threads was talking about building fantasy on the back of medieval realism and how you have to appeal to some kind of reality. I got into like a heated argument with one guy because he said the only the only truth that people need to understand your fiction is that it's written in a language they can understand. And I just thought that was the most brain dead take that you could possibly have on really fiction in general, because you have to appeal to something that people understand for them to have any kind of investment in it. You can't just show them like nonsense happening in front of them and expect them to have any kind of real investment in what's going on.
Well, I think it goes to a distinction between what I would call a classical or Enlightenment point of view and a postmodern point of view, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of postmodernists, and they make up the majority of, for instance, like the literary fiction writers, you know, who would take the view that there are no universal truths. There are merely narratives that are created by those with power to push their point of view. And there are no truths other than the truths we make. And so they would never say, like, your writing needs to express universal truths, or your fiction needs to be real, because they don't believe those things actually exist. They'll say, well, this is my lived experience. But then you have like a different school which says, no, you know, reality is real, truth is true, and there are universal values that people can share. And, you know, they write and create very different types of content, and it's a philosophical difference. And I've never been able to bridge the gap between those two groups. You know, the postmodernists go one way, and you know, the group I'm in goes the other. And it sounds like the person who made that comment about fiction, I think, was probably in that postmodern group.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing that we fight against here is that postmodernism has poisoned, again, so much of academia, so much of the literature, the fiction that we consume. I mean, James Lindsay is constantly saying we live in Marcuse's world. We live in Herbert Marcuse's world, and you know, unfortunately, he's right about that. I have yet to see any evidence to the contrary.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, they did the long march through the institutions and they won.
Yeah.
We're effectively, you know, if you think about sort of a culture war context, you know, the postmodernists had total victory, and we're like, you know, we're like the insurgents behind enemy lines, kind of popping our heads up out of cover every so often. So, yeah. And, you know, it took them years to do it, and it'll take years for a counter intellectual movement to rise to replace it, but it will eventually, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then, likely Arrow makes a good point here. Everything needs to be based on an internally consistent logic, when it comes to, you know, when it comes to fantasy, even when you're presenting a world that's essentially entirely alien from what people know and understand, you have to make that logic accessible, and it has to follow certain patterns. One, so that when those patterns are disrupted, you know that something is happening, something significant is going on. But two, to make the world make any kind of sense and make it something that people can actually interface with on an intellectual level and understand, so that they can then, you know, shape it or react to it, it does have to follow some kind of internal logic.
Yeah, absolutely. I talk about that a lot in my book, Arbiter of Worlds, because I say that the thing that tabletop games can do that almost nothing else can do is give players agency, which is the ability to make, you know, volitional choices in the world that have meaningful consequences. But to be able to make choices, you have to be able to, at the same time, predict likely outcomes of those choices in a way that makes sense. So there has to be causality, but it needs to be non-deterministic causality, because if it's all deterministic, then you're not really making any choices at all. It's just a billboard. And I think that's where a lot of, like, for instance, fourth edition D&D really broke down, was that the mechanics of the game had no connection to what was going on in the game. They were totally disassociated. And so you couldn't look at your character and think, okay, this is how the world works. You know, just arbitrarily minions would have one hit point, even though they were incredibly powerful monsters that could tear normal people apart. But they have one hit point because that makes the game work. And it just, it ended up creating a very disassociated experience that you know, pulls you out of any sense of immersion and makes it impossible to do the sort of interesting planning you were talking about, where you're like, well, I know that pole arms don't work that well in close quarters, so let me think about other methods I could get around that. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Now, these next words are going to hurt coming out of my mouth, because I am a devoted Calvinist, but when it comes to the role of the game master in, you know, arbitrating worlds, to use your tagline there, should we be approaching this more as a deistic god, a watchmaker god, rather than the god of Calvinism that is sovereign over all things and controlling all things at all times?
Yeah, that's a good question. I do think so. I think as a GM, you want to be a deist god, but you also want to be the god of the Book of Job, who is rooting for Job, even as he's allowing Satan to torture Job.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, as the GM, you're also Satan because you're playing the adversary. And as the adversary, you're using your full powers to try and make the player characters face really difficult challenges. But at the same time, you do want them to win. But you just want them to win according to the rules, according to their virtues, their strengths, their gameplay, et cetera. So, what's the word for that? What's the word for the Jobian god? I don't know, but I think that's the god you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, talk to any Calvinist and they would say that's also the god of Calvinism, but, you know, it just depends on your interpretations, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose that's fair. Yeah.
But
I'm Greek Orthodox myself, man. I don't truck with these newfangled religions.
I have a lot of respect for Orthodox, especially Greek and Antiochian. I have a tremendous amount of respect for those traditions. So, you know, I was just
born into it. I mean, I'm Greek Romanian descent, and so my dad had me baptized in the church, and so that's what we grew up with. I can't say I carefully studied the menu of Christian options to like find the perfect faith or something.
Mm-hmm.
So although I have a friend who did that, and you know, he went from an atheist to Christian, and he literally studied it like it was a series of instruction manuals, and he was looking for like the one that made the most sense. He ended up becoming a Roman Catholic. So
gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He said Roman Catholicism was the most logical religion. I was like, okay.
Yeah. Now, again, this might be kind of a heavy topic for the amount of time that we have left. But now that we've fully strayed into, the philosophy and theology territory,
yeah,
I have to ask your opinion on something that I put forward a couple weeks back, and that's this idea that even in the world of fantasy,
mm-hmm,
evil is not a force in and of itself. It's still just a privation of good. Do you think that works in medieval fantasy, where there are a lot of quote unquote forces of evil at work in a lot of these stories? Do you still think that kind of Augustinian conception of good and evil ports to tabletop gaming? Because I think it does. And
interesting. Okay. So I would say no. But I will confess, I'm not persuaded by Augustinian theodicy in the real world.
Okay.
So I'm even less persuaded by it in the game world. If I had to go with a theodicy, I would say I'm closest to either Greg Boyd's warfare theodicy or Irenaeus's suffering theodicy, where Greg Boyd says that, you know, actually our world is a war between God and Satan. And so when we suffer evil, it's because of the acts of, you know, of Satan. It's not that God wants anything evil to happen to us. And then the Irenaeans would say that when we suffer evil, you know, it's in order to level up, basically. And I think some combination of those is definitely at least where I bring my tabletop games, and is probably closest to what I think in the real world as well. Although, you know, I don't have a PhD in theology to be able to make that a more cogent argument.
Yeah. And for me, I think a lot of it comes down to especially the fact that Michael Moorcock's conception of like order versus chaos,
mm-hmm,
was brought into role playing, and that is very order versus chaos is a structure versus privation, just because chaos doesn't have a structure to it. Chaos is inherently a lack of something. So if that's your dynamic, it's you know, order, balance, and chaos, then you are dealing with a situation where evil is a lack of something.
Okay, so this is interesting, right? I've been thinking about this a lot. I wrote an essay on this on my political blog. Okay, so because I do think this sort of cosmos of structure and chaos of lack of structure is a real, you know, it is a real dualism that we encounter. So the thought process I had was as follows, is we as Christians believe that God sustains the universe at every moment.
Yeah. Right?
But we also believe that God is utterly omnipotent. And so the question is, why did God make the universe in such a way that he had to sustain it at every moment? Why didn't he create the universe such that it could function without him? Why did he make it that he has to have a 24/7 day job, in other words?
Yeah.
And my thought process was that the reason that God has to sustain the universe at every moment of time is that chaos is actually the default state to which everything returns in the absence of the constant exertion of the power of God. And so, which then leads to the conclusion that he couldn't make a universe that he didn't sustain, because that universe would inherently be without structure and would be chaotic. But if that's true, then chaos is more than just privation. Chaos is also a trend or process towards privation, which I think is what entropy is in the real world, right? Like everything is entropic except life, which miraculously is negentropic for reasons no one can understand. And that's kind of my explanation, I think. I think entropy is fundamentally the physical manifestation of evil, and the universe tends towards that except in the absence of conscious intelligence actively preventing it, which is what I think the Big Bang is. And, you know, I think it's what we're here to do on Earth. And certainly and that's actually the theology I wrote into the Aran Empire campaign setting in my tabletop RPG. So,
gotcha.
Yeah. So it's a really interesting question. I overthink these things a lot.
So you kind of take like almost a Schopenhauer approach to it.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
All right.
Fair. Yeah.
So. Now that we have completely lost everyone.
Yeah, everyone has logged off. They're like, well, yeah.
Start talking about Chesterton and Schopenhauer and Augustine. And
yeah.
Now we're done here. I do want to bring people back though, because once again, I will bring this up. You are actively doing work to spread the good word of simulationism. One way that you're doing this is on your Substack, Arbiter of Worlds. So everyone who wants to subscribe, this is where you can do it. Just, you know, go on over there. I'll drop the link here in chat and click that subscribe button. And another way that you're doing it, as we've mentioned already, is through your YouTube channel, where you're making kind of shorter videos on these individual topics.
Yeah, and I'm very new to YouTube, which is ironic because I ran The Escapist for many years and we did hundreds and hundreds of YouTube videos, but I was never really in any of them except for the occasional podcast. So this is my first time actually making YouTube videos with myself in them. And I'm told that your first 50 YouTube videos will always suck. So I'm right now on my third one. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to suck less each time. But yeah, if you check them out there, it's at youtube.com/@AlexanderMacrice is my channel right now. It's the Arbiter of Worlds channel. You can find it. And I'm kind of working through the stuff I wrote about in my book, and then I'll start delving into more topics from there.
Hmm. Yeah. Like Liero, we are not going to do Aquinas right now, because I can talk about Aquinas for a very long time, and we're just, it'll just be you listening to us talk about Aquinas. I'll put it that way.
Now do Aquinas. Hilarious. Yeah,
you've seen Summa. You know how long that book is, like Liero. Come on now.
Oh man, that's one of the few. I gotta say, that's one of the few books I did not make it through. Like I had this notion, like I was gonna read it, and it was just so long, and life caught up with me, and I didn't make it through.
I can't blame you for that.
Did you
finish
it? Did you read it?
I said I can't blame you for that at all, because I too have only read sections of the Summa.
Sections. Yeah. You were a philosophy major, right?
I was. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have a particular philosopher that you focused on, or a particular school? Or
unfortunately, towards the end of my time in college, it was a lot of, we're going to be reading Marx, and we're going to be reading Kimberly Crenshaw, and we're going to be reading pretty much all the architects of everything wrong with the world right now.
Right, right. Yeah.
I personally gravitated more towards, well, Aquinas, but also I really enjoyed Kierkegaard.
Oh, okay. I didn't think anyone enjoyed Kierkegaard.
Saying I enjoy Kierkegaard is kind of like saying I enjoy getting punched, but
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
it's that, but it was that like emotional reaction.
Right.
Kierkegaard was the only philosopher I read that made me go, whoa, instead of,
Interesting. So you were moved by him. Your
Yes.
spirit was moved. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Could see that. I recently discovered Middle Platonism, which I had never read in college or grad school, and guys on my Substack pointed me to it. And I kind of through sheer happenstance saw this comment and I was like, oh, that's really interesting. So I've been reading about the Middle Platonists, like Plutarch, who wrote the famous Plutarch's Lives series of history, was a Middle Platonist. And I'm like, I think this is my philosophical home now. It rings true to me. So it's kind of weird to like, I thought I had all these original thoughts in my head, and it actually turns out that some Greek dudes 3,000 years ago had already worked it all out and were like, hey, bro, we already wrote a book. Okay. I'm sure that's a common experience for you as a philosophy major as well. No matter, you climb up this mountain and they're like already there chilling out, eating grapes. I'm just like, okay.
Oh, you made it out of the cave.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you made it out. Exactly. It's like, finally, good to see you. How you been? Yeah. Yeah. So,
All right,
but yeah.
likely Arrow, you brought it up, so I have to say this. My threads about the different fantasy races, I very
Oh.
heavily incorporated fear and trembling into that because it's my personal belief that dwarves and halflings are representative of the toad in the swamp. They are concerned entirely with the physical, with what's in front of them. They have little to no spiritual concern. It's just, the halflings do it in a hedonistic way. The dwarves do it in a very utilitarian, practical way. The elves are they're the knight of infinite resignation. They're all the way up here. They are so far beyond the physical world that they're aloof to everything that's physical. They're playing their harps and off in their cities. But humans, what makes humans the central race in fantasy and what makes them the most important race is they're the knight of faith. They exist in both realms and they move seamlessly between them. And they're the only fantasy race that's capable of doing that.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I hope if you create a setting, you'll incorporate that somehow.
I am planning on doing that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So
Huh.
enough of again, we keep getting into these heavy topics.
I blame your viewers. They're asking us
Yes.
heavy questions. It's all their fault.
And yes, Crafty, I took an undue amount of shit for expressing that opinion where someone said this is a white supremacist's view of fantasy, and I was just like that
Oh yeah, I saw
blocked.
that tweet. Yep. Well, you take flak when you're over the target, I guess.
Yes.
I took a lot of heat for my view on orcs, right? Which was that orcs are the xenomorphs from Aliens, and if you're trying to humanize them, you're Burke. And Burke was the villain of Aliens, right? The hero of Aliens was Ripley, and her idea was to take off and nuke the site from orbit. And that's how a paladin should view orcs, because they're innately evil monstrosities who are antithetical to human life. And and you say that, and so then people are like, well, oh, so you hate black people. So yeah, that's just the world we live in, though.
Yep. But on a lighter but equally important note, I do want to direct people towards the Kickstarter that you have ongoing right now. We've mentioned Ascendant. I will once again play Vanna White here and hold it up for you guys to see. Beautiful James Shields cover to tie into last week's episode. This is your second printing, Ascendant Platinum Edition. Some of the tiers also include the graphic novel, which I also own, but it's downstairs. So tell people what they can expect from this campaign, which has currently 61 hours left to go.
Yeah, so when I created Ascendant, I did not realize it would be as popular as it was. And it ended up, you know, hitting platinum way faster than Axe did and sold out of its entire print run. And I had planned to do my second Kickstarter for Ascendant was going to be the Ascendant Rogues Gallery, which is a source book with tons of villains and story hooks and things so that you can easily game master the game. But now all of a sudden I was out of the core rules. And so how do you sort of sell a supplement for a book that's out of print, right? Like I had kind of put myself in a weird position. So I decided to do the Kickstarter instead for the second printing of Ascendant with Rogues Gallery and the graphic novel also being available. So you can just get the core rules, the Ascendant second printing if you want. You can get Ascendant and Ascendant Rogues Gallery. You can get the core rules in the graphic novel. You can get the Rogues Gallery in the graphics novel, or you can get all three as a bundle. And, you know, the only thing you need to play is the core rules. But the, you know, the Rogues Gallery adds a ton of new characters and fills out the universe more. And of course the graphic novel is just a fun read with lots of fun art. So.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you guys, this is an amazing book. We will be returning to talk more about Ascendant at the beginning of next month, because I will be hosting Servant of Shiloh on here. We'll be talking about superhero RPGs.
Nice.
And Ascendant will be one of the ones that I bring up.
Yeah, I mean, Ascendant is absolutely a simulationist game. You know, it's an attempt to simulate superhero physics, which isn't simulating real world physics, right? Like we're simulating superhero physics. But it's pretty hilarious when you get into that mindset and you start to think about the funny things your characters can do in the game world. And you know, it does stuff no other game does, and I'm very proud of it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also, for all of the other things that you have done, including Axe, including one of my personal favorite books. By this Axe, the Cyclopedia of Dwarven Civilization, you can find all of this and more on Drive-Thru. You have a lot of great stuff here. You can get the PDF for Ascendant here. Again, just lots of amazing stuff to be found on your Drive-Thru page.
Thank you. Yeah, By this Axe was a ton of fun to write. And it was funny because, you know, I'm writing this book about the dwarven race. So, you remember we were talking earlier about like iconoclastic views that are just contrary to the trends?
Yeah.
Like here's me writing a book about the dwarven race at the same time as they're eliminating the concept of race from D&D. And I'm just like, could I be more out of step? But it was hugely successful. So I think sometimes it really pays dividends to buck the trends and sort of go your own way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, it's one of those things where, yes, you can be successful chasing trends. Some people have made a career out of that.
Yes.
But at the same time, there's a lot of people who have failed to do so. And so, you know, at some point, you have to ask yourself, do I want to continue chasing these trends? Or do I want to maybe set a trend of my own? And... Yep. Be even more successful and feel better about myself than I did originally. And so I applaud you for going in that direction.
Thank you. I don't know if I've set any trends yet, but I've perhaps paved the way for trends to later develop. We'll see.
I'll tell you what, just based on our conversation tonight and knowing several people who feel the same way that we do, let's devote ourselves to making this a trend.
All right, we're gonna make it a trend.
I will do whatever I can to work alongside you to make simulationism great again.
Hashtag simulationism. That's right. Hashtag bringing it back.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Well, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I said awesome. I'm in.
Cool. All right. Well, guys, that's going to do it for tonight's episode. This has been a great conversation. And again, just anytime you want to come on and talk about anything, just let me know, because I always I always look forward to these conversations because we go down so many of these weird rabbit holes about Kierkegaard and Chesterton and things like that. So
awesome. I always enjoy having you on. I don't remember the last time I was on a show where we ended up talking about, you know, the theodicy of Dungeons and Dragons. Like, that's doesn't happen on TikTok, I'll tell you that for sure. Yeah,
definitely not. All right, well, guys, next week, Viktor Gorchev will be returning for his second appearance, and we'll be talking all about Modern Necessities, his recently released modern fantasy supplement for Old School Essentials. I'm looking forward to it. I'm probably still working on supplemental material for his Modern Necessities campaign. So now that his book is out, we'll probably spend a lot of time talking about stuff that I have in the works for it. We'll talk about how OSE works in kind of a modern type setting. So all of that conversation will happen next week. So until then, whether you rolled a 1 or a 20, I am so glad that you rolled your bones with me, Ryan Howard, and I will see you guys next time.